Everyone should send in mailbag questions. Welcome to the Cutting the Gordian Knot podcast, mailbag, all of Abby's question edition. We have 15 excellent questions to go through, covering theological, economic, and well, every other conceivable topic, it would seem. If you want to put in a mailbag question, just email me at thegordianknot101@gmail.com. And yeah, you can send anything you like, any comments for the show. Let me know how you heard about it. All righty, what do we have for number one? Is there a rule of thumb for how economic regulations can be in line with a free market philosophy? We need some regulations, but I feel like conservative people tend to think that any new regulations will ruin the economy and are just intrinsically against free trade. Yeah, I think I could give a couple rules of thumb. First is, if a regulation makes a price more and not less accurate, then I think it's a good regulation. For instance, let's say we have a trucking company that carts coal across public roads to a second location to, I don't know, burn the coal, for instance. And it is tearing up all the roadways. Well, maybe they're using, making this up on the fly, in the wintertime, chains on their tires because it's very easy, and chains on the tires of large equipment just destroy roads. Well, it's benefiting from being able to deploy a very cheap solution to move its coal from one place to another, but it's coming at the expense of this city who is covering the cost of the roads. So they might do a regulation that says, like many municipalities have, no chains on your tires. And this would make them have to find another solution that doesn't harm the common good, that doesn't push costs onto others, and it might be a slightly more expensive snow tire instead. That means that the real price of going from point A to point B with the coal is better captured than before, because it has an implicit subsidy in the first case where it's pushing costs onto the public. So if it's a regulation like that that makes a negative externality become priced in, then I think that's probably a good idea. Now you might be wondering, well, why not just tax to the extent that the negative externality is there? Well, sometimes that does make sense. However, regulations can be better than taxes when the compliance cost of taxes would be too high, when the tax avoidance rate would be too high, or would be benefiting dishonest companies at the expense of honest companies. It could be reasonable if the regulation just wants to completely block out, say, an immoral activity. So if we wanted to get rid of methamphetamines, it might be smarter to just plain old regulate that no company can manufacture them, instead of saying they're just taxed at a really high rate. So I would give those situations as reasonable situations for a regulation versus a tax, and regulations or taxes ought to be putting the price of a negative externality back into, in a proportional way, the cost of a given product. So I'd say that would be one. Another one is, regulations can help to keep companies from racing to the bottom in certain respects. One of them would be safety. I'm in support of some safety regulations. And the reason why is, I don't think workers are always competent to estimate the safety of a given workplace. Now, maybe they could if they're looking at joining a lumber company or something. Maybe they could estimate that one pretty reasonably. But if it's a chemical company, I wouldn't expect your Joe average worker to understand to what extent there should be certain safety regulations surrounding different chemical substances. I mean, I think that would take a lot of research and knowledge that really can't be expected of just the random person who's shopping for a good job, mainly based on price, convenience, things like that. So I think that there should be regulations governing safety, which mean that we don't just have companies with the least amount of safety outcompeting those with higher amounts of safety. I don't want to give them a head start by sacrificing worker safety. Now, this is all in balance, right? We understand that people do need to take on dangerous tasks sometimes, but giving disclosure protecting from, you know, the worst possible outcomes, I think it makes sense with the regulation. Same with like honesty in advertising. Burger King's being sued right now because their burgers look very different in person than from their marketing material. And that can be a good place for regulation to say, when you're marketing something, it needs to bear at least this much resemblance to what one can expect. Because again, we could have an unsustainable race to the bottom. Now, free market advocates such as myself might return that, well, they're just destroying their brand equity. And that's true. But I mean, there's times and places where we can just say there's other ways to build your brand equity. And we'd prefer that companies don't just build it and then just scam people and slowly destroy their firm's future value. So it can make sense to have regulations for that kind of stuff, too. Final place which I think regulations can make sense is for national security, right? So keeping secret things secret, keeping technologies away from being open source to enemies that might use them against us. And there could be even be regulations which should keep key industries in a very safe, friendly supply chain so that in the event of war, we don't find all of our ammunition being manufactured by our enemy, for instance. We would need that capability on our shores. So those are the options I would put forward. I think that those are general rules of thumb on how we should be viewing regulations. Next one, the ozone layer healing seems like an interesting example of economic policy that benefited the environment. Do you know if there are any major economic downfalls of those regulations? To my knowledge, there actually were not any major economic downfalls. Now, in general, in the ecological community, this is viewed as like the poster child for regulatory success. And it was very successful. There was a real problem where the chlorofluorocarbons can break apart the third oxygen from a ozone, which is an O3, turn it into O2. And this means that it can't absorb the incoming UV radiation. So the ozone layer is protective of all sorts of life. If we didn't have it ever, then life probably could never have evolved on our planet. So pretty important stuff. It was Cook in New Zealand, and they were experiencing massive cancer rates as that area was opening up, and UV was hitting Middle Earth, guys. So that's no good. Overall, successful policy. The costs were the refrigerant was more expensive when they came up with an alternative. And I believe many of them included massive amounts of butane, which makes it very dangerous compared to the earlier, safer alternative. Longevity and efficiency of those units wasn't quite as good as before, though things are catching up. Granted, they're more expensive and cumbersome now. So, yeah, I mean, there was a cost, but overall, I would say that was probably worth it and a good example of a good global collective action. Now, we mentioned regulations earlier. I do have some problems with how they've tried to stop this from getting into the atmosphere. One of them is, legally, people can't unhook their own AC units because it's going to release all sorts of chlorofluorocarbons. And you have to instead pay somebody to vacuum it out at your own expense. Now, that's a problem. Because, seriously, guys, what are people going to do? Are they going to be responsible and say, well, you know, I got to do my small part for the ozone layer? Or are they just going to hack it open, say, it's not going to make a big difference, and not have to pay some overpriced HVAC company? Because that happens all the time. What you're asking these homeowners to do is to take on the cost to themselves of your priority. Instead, I think that the people who have this priority should be the ones who cover the cost of making this happen. So a regulation I would prefer is a hotline that says, call, 511 if you have some gas that's going to be released, and we'll send an HVAC company over at our expense, at government expense, to evacuate it before you perform the rest of your job. So the country as a whole decided through a political process that this is something it wanted to do. It wanted to reduce chlorofluorocarbons in the atmosphere. Therefore, we as a whole should be paying for it. We shouldn't be pushing this on individual people. And I think that would have resulted in a lot less avoidance. This is similar to like the misutility model where you call 811 and people come over for free to check if there's any utilities in the area you're about to dig. Because you might not care that much if you destroy somebody else's utility, but they really, really, really do. So instead of charging you, they make it free so that they'll get much higher compliance. That's what I would have suggested in this case. 3. The Founding Fathers set up the Supreme Court judges with lifelong terms to keep them from being corrupted. I've heard people say that they should have term limits, since it doesn't seem to be fixing their corruption. What do you think? Well, I think we have to define corruption a little bit. I don't think they're being paid off. I do think they're being politically pressured, and I think that a lifetime appointment will make them more and not less resilient. I'm sure they can still be pressured. I would say that makes it better. It's similar to like tenure for a professor. You can really lay out your real thoughts at that point. Also, I like that law is slow moving, especially at the Supreme Court level. I think that would give us a little bit more continuity in law. And I'll point out that depending on the alternative, if we have people running or seeking to be elected or appointed more often or in consecutive terms, if that's allowed, then we experience the problems we've seen at lower levels. There's pretty strong data to support the idea that judges who are running up to an election or an appointment are much harsher in their sentencing because they don't want to go a little too soft on somebody and then get a terrible news story about how they let some criminal off. They'd prefer to be too harsh and just have these people safely locked away than to be too lenient. And I think this is a terrible effect because what we want them to do is to bring justice. I don't want them to be too lenient. I don't want them to be too harsh. And I certainly want their stupid political ambitions to influence this. That's entirely evil. This is somebody's life in a cell that you're affecting. So I want less of that. So lifetime appointments, if they're getting less of that, that's definitely a pro. But yeah, I'd have to know more about what you mean by corruption. If it's just being swayed politically, then I think that there is a bit of an advantage for a lifetime appointment, but I haven't thought that deeply into it. 4, do you think we could ever have an economy that's not based on labor? In a strict sense, no, because economically speaking, church document speaking, and even Jewish tradition, all speaks of capital as a type of old or solidified labor, and even talks about money as a liquid labor. So capital is making us money because it's just a past labor that created that capital, and that past labor is still adding value. So if you created a machine to make candy corn, and it's still making candy corn, then your past labor is still yielding candy corn off into the future. Wonderful. But I kind of doubt that was the thrust of the question. So instead, I'll take it from a different perspective. So if we don't have labor in our economy, so there's no demand for it, let's say, then that would mean that the price of labor would be zero if we have zero demand. But if it's the price is zero, that would imply that the marginal benefit of the additional hour of labor is also zero, because if it was more than zero, then it would be demanded. But if that were the case and there was no marginal benefit of the additional hour of labor, then that would actually imply that every single person's desire for any possible thing has already been met, and nobody wants anything increased in quantity or quality. So we would be like living in heaven. I don't think that's going to happen. I think that our demand for things is pretty much limitless. We could always want maybe one more thing, which is in quantity or something a little bit higher in quality. I think I've given this analogy before. And I'm probably going to get the numbers wrong this time because I'm forgetting them, so I'll try to get basic magnitudes. Volkswagen said that in their plant, they can build a Volkswagen Jetta in about 16 hours of labor. And BMW says that their BMW 7 Series, which is a much nicer car, takes something like 85 hours to build. So let's say we deployed machines that could remove an average amount of labor from the vehicle production process. Well, that would mean that, say, if that was 20-something, then the Jetta would be fully automated and we wouldn't need any of that. But the 7 Series might need some additional work. And then, maybe the next year, automakers say, you know, people can get a Volkswagen Jetta for less, but we could add some features. We could make it more like that 7 Series. We could make it higher quality, more powerful. But, we would need a few more man hours. So they might end up having people working alongside those robots and producing higher quality goods. So something that would up the Jetta to 7 Series level. And if you look at the history of car production, this is kind of what happened. We just increased the quality and the quantity of vehicles instead of just making everybody fired because we automated things. Kind of on that subject, labor can, so if we displace labor with capital, we could always, and then we're at like state zero. So everything today gets produced by, machinery, AI, whatever. Then tomorrow we could increase either the quality of everything by bringing those laborers back, or we could bring more quantity of everything by bringing the laborers back. Or if there's still a blend of labor and capital, we could bring in other laborers in to increase leisure time for the first laborers. So at any point really that we can imagine capital being deployed, we could always add labor to make things better. I know I've been a bit long-winded on this question, but that's my basic answer. You could always get a marginal benefit from the addition of labor. And if that wasn't true, then that would imply a state of absolute abundance for everybody on Earth, which I don't think we're ever going to reach. So we'll always have labor. Why aren't the baptized noticeably better people? A couple reasons. One, I think selection bias. Religion is based around understanding first that you're a sinner and that you're in need of help. It could be that that selects for people who were worse than the people who thought, well, I'm not that bad and could have been kind of right. So selection bias is very possible. But more than that, I'm going to give the gym member analogy. Baptism brings you into the church, installs you into the body of Christ, and gives you a pardon of all sins. It wipes all sins from you, even original sin. So my analogy is, it's like getting a gym membership. You are now included into a community. There are now things at your disposal that can make your physical body stronger. You went from a state of deficiency vis-a-vis the means by which you can become strong to a state of abundance, whereby there are many, many things that can help you out. Now, if you go to a gym, do you think you're going to see people who are stronger or weaker than average? Do you think they'd be noticeably stronger at a gym? Well, it kind of depends. Like, there are some gyms where, yes, they're powerlifting gyms, and they will all be stronger. But if you go to a garden variety Planet Fitness, what you'll notice is there's a lot of people who have recognized how fat and unhealthy they are and go to the gym. And then there are some people who are trying to improve themselves and are very strong. And what you really notice is a difference in the distribution of strength at a gym. You get the really, really fat who recognize they're in need of a gym. And then you get the really, really strong who have made good use of the gym. And this is what I think coming into the church through baptism does. I think it changes the distribution. In a gym, you'll find some of the strongest people in your city. And in a church, you will find some of the most virtuous people in your city. But you'll also find some of the fattest people at the gym and some of the most wicked people in your church, changes that distribution. But I think to say that, well, because there's no huge difference between people who hold a gym membership and people who don't, therefore the gym does not make you stronger, I think that statement would be false. I think that you definitely require it. It's a necessary but not a sufficient condition in this case, as is baptism. There have been some numbers on things like divorce, and they dig into things more than just has somebody been baptized. But they looked at baptized versus unbaptized people with divorce, and I think it was a little bit in favor of people who were baptized. Then they look into church attendance, then attendance in a Catholic church, then weekly attendance in a Catholic church. They're married in the church, and they regularly receive the sacraments. If you do those things, your risk of divorce is less than 2%. So I guess the other way I'm going to answer this question is, I bet you if we dug into the data more and we looked at the other sacraments being deployed in light of the fact you're already baptized, we're going to get a big difference. Kind of like the gym membership gets you in the gym, and now using the machines would be the equivalent to, say, confession and the Eucharist and being involved in your church community and prayer, right? That will make you stronger, but you need that initial entrance. All right, question 6. What's the symbolism behind, I really like this question, Judas dipping his bread in the bowl after betraying Jesus? There's a couple options. I'll leave my take to last. One is, some people believe that this is a part of the Passover meal whereby you dip into like this bitter herb and red wine vinegar or salt mixture. And this represents Joseph having his garment dipped in the blood during his betrayal. So it could be that he's using this point, which represents a betrayal, to show that Judas is doing the same thing as Joseph's brothers did, which makes sense because that was a gathering of the 12, and this is a gathering of the 12. So yeah, I think that's probably a pretty good read. St. Augustine says that this represents the dying or staining of his soul, just as that what he's dipping in, that morsel is being stained or dyed. It's a permanent change on his soul at this point. And Jesus is saying, hey, this is forever. You are marking your soul in this way. Augustine goes on to say that receiving Christ's body unworthily has a curse on it. And Judas is subsequently entered by Satan. So it could be that he's receiving the Eucharist, that this bread that is being given to him has already been transubstantiated, and now he is taking a curse upon himself in knowledge of his betrayal. Origen says that Judas didn't eat the bread because Satan, having taken control of him, would have been afraid of being cast out upon him eating what Jesus gave him, because at that point it was the Eucharist. And the Gnostics, who are wrong, we don't like the Gnostics guys, have a very interesting and totally wrong read, whereby this is a participation in Jesus' sacrifice, and Judas was the good guy, where he is basically offering his soul up to be damned. He's giving himself over to Satan in order to fulfill the prophecies that the Messiah will be betrayed and given over. So he basically volunteers for this role in light of the terrible punishment that's coming. I don't think that's true, but that's another read of the passage. My take is that this is his body descending down into what I'm pretty sure he dipped into was like a vinegar salt water mixture, which represented the tears and trials that the people of Israel experienced when they were going through the desert onto the promised land. So what Jesus is saying is, hey, you're going to go descend into the place of tears that I'm going. Like basically, hey, Judas, you're betraying me. And guess what? You're coming with me. Don't think you're going to escape the same thing that's happening to me. Don't think you're going to get off scot-free. This was a warning to him, in my opinion. showing him that you too are going to descend into this terrible place. And that's what happened, right? He goes and commits suicide after he takes all of those coins and he throws them, I think, into the temple. And so he does indeed die like Jesus died. So it's not just that his betrayal kills Jesus and he gets off scot-free. Jesus is showing him, this is going to happen to you too. Are you ready, buddy? Question 7. Why don't we have the highest senses? There's a shrimp that can see more colors than we can. Birds can sense the magnetic field, etc. Well, I have good news, dear listeners. You too have a weak magnetic sense because you have some iron deposits in your nose. Some have argued these are vestigial, but I'm not entirely sure if that's true. We seem to be able to use these. I believe there were some studies which removed it or increased it and showed people could sense north better. So you might have that one after all. What we can and can't see is based on our environment and what kind of needs we had. So we're not pollinators, so we can't expect to see all of the ranges of colors that pollinators can on what would have been white flowers, but turns out are not. We're not deep in the ocean, so we don't require that shift of color based on what's being filtered out through the water. So I know that's kind of a boring answer, but let me answer it a different way. You can't sell us too short physical body-wise versus animals because I think we have a lot going for us. We don't just have reason and all that. We have excellent eyesight. We have pretty good hearing. We have a pretty decent sense of smell. People think that dogs smell way better than us, but there have been studies using undergrads trying to sniff things out, and undergrads are pretty good sniffers too. But then we have things like long distance running. The only animals that can keep up with us over a long distance are wolves and horses. There's even a race which pits people against horses, and people sometimes win. Throwing ability, we are all stars there. And then just being able to run through obstacles. If you watch people who do parkour and free running, no animal can follow you jumping over the buildings and stuff like that. Maybe a jaguar or something could follow you on some of those huge leaps, but they can't do the bouldering and climbing. And some type of a monkey or an ape could follow you on the bouldering and climbing, but can't get up the speed to do the massive jumps and rolls. And just can't do that. Also, as far as non-aquatic mammals, to my knowledge, the fastest swimmers. We're really fast swimmers. So we can keep up with anything that's not full-on water-adapted, mammal-wise. I'll add a few more. Look up reindeer eyes. They can see ultraviolets. So they have a crazy purple-looking eyeball, so check that one out. And I have a request for St. Joseph episode. This will come eventually. You are not alone in wanting this episode. There have been others as well. And one day it will arrive when I feel like I can put something good together. My patron saint is St. Joseph, and above my recording pillow fort, I have a hand-carved icon of St. Joseph. So, big fan. We definitely need to talk about that fellow. The problem is, there's not much about him. So, really going to have to mind as many sources as I can to put together a whole episode. Number 9. If you could shrink one large animal to be pet-sized, what would it be? Now, this one really, really bugged me. This is very, very, very hard. But I finally came up with an answer. The bison. People love mini horses, so I feel like that's already a decent analog. And in the news, we've seen all sorts of people being trampled and mauled by bison, mostly California residents going and visiting the West. So people have an innate love of bison enough to clearly risk life and limb. But if they were smaller, I feel like they'd be less dangerous. So there you go. Number 10, who would win, a taco or a grilled cheese? Well, if it's a fight, it's definitely going to go to the grilled cheese because even just eating a taco, even just looking at a taco can cause it to completely fall apart. So no hit points there. It's just going down in a fight. If we're talking about which one is generally more delicious, now it's going to swap. Tacos can be incredibly delicious, so they're going to top out really, really high. And you may be thinking, well, can't a grilled cheese also top out at an extraordinarily high level? Well, there's the rub. I believe that you can add one ingredient to a grilled cheese that is not, you know, bread and cheese and butter and things, and it can still be a grilled cheese. But if you go to two ingredients, it stops being a grilled cheese and it becomes a sandwich. Now, which is better, a taco or a sandwich? That's tough. I don't know. But as far as being a grilled cheese, you're going to top out pretty quick because you can only add one ingredient before you become a sandwich. I don't know if I've shared my breakthrough recipe for grilled cheese on air yet, but do this, dear listener. Many mornings, and all through Lent, I would make a grilled cheese for breakfast. You take a half pound, that's right, a half pound of Munster cheese, throw it in a nonstick pan, and start getting it all bubbly and crispy. This is step one. As the oil separates from the delicious bubbly cheese, take some pieces of bread, as good of a bread as you can find, and dip it in so that it becomes covered in cheese oil. Now, load the deliciously bubbly cheese into the inside of your sandwich and fry it up. Now it's being fried in cheese oil on both sides. It's melty and bubbly on the inside. You vastly decrease the time it takes to make the grilled cheese, and I guarantee you it tastes better. Optional additions are some type of marmalade or jam, Dijon mustard, or red onions. All those, fantastic. Question 11, are roller skates or roller blades better? Well, for girls, the answer is the roller blade. It's faster, it's more maneuverable, it's more mature. For guys, the answer is they are equal. Each one will equally let your dad know that you are gay. Okay, maybe too much, just kidding, guys. But we have to throw some shade on guys who run around rollerblading and roller skating. It could be okay. It could be entirely straight. Just don't like lick an ice cream cone as you go. And I think you're in the clear. Number 12. I haven't seen the movie yet. You could do a good Barbie episode. I don't think I can bring myself to watch Barbie. I don't know. I think that might be desk. I will do a lot for you guys, but watching the Barbie movie might be a bridge too far. I will be doing a review of something pop culture-y, and that is the song Rich Men North of Richmond. So I'm going to be doing kind of an economic, societal something analysis of that song, kind of in the same vein as the Taylor Swift and Michael Jackson Beat It song review that I did in the past. 13. What's the best flavor of jam? I've got to give it to a seedless blackberry jam. In college, I would buy those take-and-bake French breads, and I'd turn them into massive peanut butter and jelly sandwiches with blackberry jam and throw it in the oven at 400 degrees so that it would become crispy on the outside and gooey and delicious on the inside. It was a very cheap and very delicious meal. More food. Question 14, what's a food that never tastes as good as homemade? I worked in restaurants from 16 to 23 years old or something. So I always had a hobby of cooking. So a lot of my cooking skills made their way into the restaurants I was at. And a lot of my restaurant training made its way into my home. So really, this line is very blurry. I really have no idea where the line is. But I'm going to say that grilled cheese that I mentioned, fantastic at home, even better than what you can find somewhere else. Any soup, in restaurants, soup is typically whatever they need to get rid of and is not usually the main chef who's making the soup. It's just Joe Random who throws it together. Well, bravo, we've used some things up. Bread, that's another one. Homemade bread, nice, fresh, out of the oven. You really can't beat that. And I think this is the last question coming up. What is the best style of dancing? This one I have a very clear answer to, and that is the type of ridiculous and goofy dancing that one does by themselves in the car to trashy pop music. I think it proves once and for all that everybody can dance, but just not everybody can use their legs. When you're in a seated position in your car, you are a phenomenal dancer. Yes, even you, I'm sure. All right, well, that does it for the mailbag. So email me in some more questions at thegordianknot101@gmail.com with any questions, suggestions, anything you want to let me know. I always greatly enjoy hearing from you guys, and I hope you join me for the next episode.